And joining me now is Dr. Dustin Calhoun. He's an associate professor of emergency medicine at UC Health and the medical director for emergency management. Dr. Calhoun, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you for having me on again.
It's our pleasure to have you. We talked with Senator Rob Portman as part of his media conference call earlier this week, and he says that he expects within the week, about 7 days or so, which would be early next week, that UC Health will receive one of these Cobas 6800 machines. Is that timeline accurate for you?
Yes, that's our understanding, too. We anticipate having it functioning, because there's a little bit of work that has to be done once it's on site. We anticipate having it functioning the 10th through the 13th, somewhere in that timeline.
Okay, and Senator Portman said that this is a pretty big machine. And so can you tell us a little bit about where it goes and what type of work you have to do to bring it online?
Well, there are a number of things that so I can't take any credit for that. It's our folks in our fantastic laboratory that have done all the work in figuring out what kind of machine works best for this, how to do it, and how to get it set up. But there are some things that they have to do when it gets here to make sure that it's functioning properly and to make sure that it's set, I guess is a way to think of it, for the swabs that we'll be using and the environment that it's in. So those are the things that they have to do to it. But it is a very impressive machine.
Well, we read in the news release that UC Health distributed that this machine, which is developed by the Swiss company Roche, can process up to 384 results every 8 hours, more than 1,000 in a 24-hour period. That's according to the company Roche. Talk to us about what that means. How does it work?
Well, so this, it's not the only machine that we're using. There are a number of machines. From the very beginning of this, we started trying to get our capability up very early. So we've probably been working on getting our capability to do in-house lab testing now for about 4 weeks. And there, we actually have a machine currently running that runs a smaller volume than this over a longer period of time. So our current capabilities are approximately 96 tests per 24-hour period. Whereas with the Cobas 6800 machine, that will more than double that, because with the supply of testing materials that we're able to get and some of the restraints around using it, we'll be running it at about 190 tests every 8 hours.
Okay.
190 tests a day at about an 8-hour turnaround time.
So do you expect to be maintaining the same standards of the targets for testing, people who are showing more than just mild symptoms?
Well, so we will primarily be testing people that are showing symptoms. So that's kind of an important point, and that's where a lot of the uncertainty about testing comes in, actually. So I know that people have probably seen news and things like that about the low sensitivity of the testing, or the talking about high false positive rate is the way sometimes the media will refer to it. High false negative rate is sometimes the way the media will refer to it. There are a lot of things that go into how sensitive a test is. How well is it? How good does it do when it comes to picking up a disease? Some of that comes from how you obtain the sample. So do you do a really good job of obtaining that swab in the nasal cavity, which is not a comfortable procedure. So some people are a little bit hesitant with it and don't get the sample that you really need. That would lower your sensitivity and make it look like a worse test, and that has nothing to do with the machine. Then the machine itself has something to do with it as far as how small a number of copies of the virus it can pick up. These machines are excellent. They can pick up a very, very small number of copies of the virus. We wouldn't bring on a machine that wasn't very sensitive. So when you get a good sample and you're in the right patient population, we look at these machines as probably having somewhere in the realm of a 90% sensitivity, meaning picking up 90 out of 100 cases when done in the right patients. And we don't know those numbers for sure, because it's a very new test in a very new patient population, and getting a really hard data on that takes years. One of the other components, though, which is what you were getting to, is how many symptoms or what symptoms does the patient have. So we don't know that having worse symptoms makes you more or less likely to have a positive test. But we do know that having symptoms does seem to affect it. So someone who has no symptoms at all is likely to have less virus and be shedding less virus and have less virus for the machine to pick up. So testing patients that have no symptoms in many settings is not going to be as sensitive. It's not going to be as useful. So we are primarily aiming our testing capabilities at patients that have the symptoms, and we're trying to use those testing capabilities in the way that's wisest for the community. So just testing someone to put a name on their particular viral syndrome, when they're doing well, they're stable, and even if they have something other than COVID-19, would still need to stay at home in order not to pass on whatever they do have, doesn't really affect things a lot. Now, you know, arguments can be made about epidemiology for sure, and that is important. But the thing that we can really make the difference for the community is in saving PPE, personal protective equipment, and getting people taken care of who have higher risk of having problems. So catching those folks that are likely to deteriorate, because one of the things that we found with this disease is that when people deteriorate, they do it quickly. So catching those people with a lot of risk factor for a bad outcome and having them with higher monitoring or bringing them into the hospital possibility. And more importantly, when we bring people into the hospital, being able to know quickly whether or not they truly have this disease so we can limit who we have to use the valuable masks and shields and gowns on when we have such limited supply. If you use it on everyone who has a virus that doesn't need it, then we wind up running out, and that causes a problem for us and for the community. So that's really a long answer to where we're trying to concentrate our testing right now. Does that make that? I hope that clears it up a little bit.
No, I so much appreciate that explanation. Thank you. And again, we're talking with Dr. Dustin Calhoun from UC Health, where he is the medical director for emergency management and an associate professor of emergency medicine. I want to hear a little bit more about the technology. What's different about this machine compared to other machines, other than the volume? Is it still examining the same type of swab that's been used previously?
Yeah, so they do all use essentially the same kind of concept. It's a swab. You can think of it as a fancy Q-tip that goes into the back of the nose, what we call the nasopharynx, which is sort of where the nose connects to the back of the throat, sort of. You swab and get fluid and cells from the mucous membranes back there, and then that gets put into a special medium called a viral transport medium, and some of the machines can do it in other things. And then that is cared for in a proper way, needs to be refrigerated, those sort of things, and then taken to the lab. And what the lab does is they expose it to various kinds of processes that essentially break down all of the material in there, and then they expose it to other processes that separate it out in order to make, basically, you can think of it like a pattern. And everybody has probably seen these. If you've ever watched CSI, they're real popular. They like to show these things on CSI, where it looks like little lines chasing each other down a page. But it's called a polymerase chain reaction that is used, or PCR, or reverse transcriptase PCR. So most of these tests do that. And by doing that, they break down the material that the virus is made out of and then test for it. And it's the most accurate way of doing it. There are other ways. There are some of these, the blood tests that you're seeing come on the market, that typically are going to have a lower accuracy because they're testing more for the body's reaction to the virus than for the virus itself.
Well, that's very interesting. I'm curious, because we've heard a lot about the limited number of testing kits available. What's the situation in that respect now, even though you have this new machine that can process more tests more quickly throughout a day? If you don't have enough kits, will that be relevant? Irrelevant.
Right, and that is super important as well. And when we talk about testing kits, there's sort of two aspects to that also. There's the stuff that you use to get the material to test, the swab, and then the viral transport media that you put it in. And then there's also the stuff you use to run the test, the stuff that does the PCR, the stuff that breaks the material down, and then the reagents that are used in the machine itself. So those are two different components. And early on, one of the problems we had when we didn't have our own internal testing is we were running out of swabs initially. And then when we got enough swabs, we started running out of the viral culture media. With the machines, we still have to keep those in mind because you use essentially the same swab and media for all of the machines that we're using anyway. But then you also have, like you said, the stuff that actually goes in or works with the machine to do the test itself, and that's also limiting. Now, one of the nice things that we have is we have some folks that work really hard at finding those different materials and sourcing them from everywhere they can, and one of the things that I've been informed comes with the machine that we're getting is essentially as guaranteed as things can get these days, supply of sufficient to do about 190 of those tests a day. So that is a pretty impressive and special thing at this point in time, considering all the shortages that we have going on.
Can you just tell us a little bit about what things look like for you and your team and people in your profession there on the front lines?
Well, everyone is busy, and I think that that pretty much goes for everyone in healthcare right now or anything that supports healthcare. Fortunately for us in this region right now, most of the busy is in planning. Now, there's been a lot of planning that's gone into this before now, but we're doing a lot to plan now that we're getting some more modeling numbers as to how many we may see in this region. So putting some of these theoretical plans that we've had on the books for years and that we think about into where the rubber meets the road, really coming up with where do we put this number of patients, because some of the models that we're looking at do demonstrate quite a few patients that we're going to have to be able to handle. So we have a lot of people working very hard right now to figure that out. And to plan for that. If you're putting patients in areas that you don't normally put them, or putting ICU patients in places that you normally wouldn't put ICU patients, but you'd put what we call med-surg or sort of a more stable patient, you have to do some things to change what's in there. You have to do some things to change the staffing model. And then we're also trying to keep in mind things like our own providers and our own staff and nurses are going to get sick to some degree. They're part of the population, so we will have some folks that get sick. And then we'll have folks that have the regular things in their life that take them out of work. So we have to keep in mind staffing shortages that can occur. So all of those kind of planning, that's what's keeping us busy right now. And I'm sure in the coming weeks, what's going to keep us busy is taking care of patients, like what you're seeing as you look around the country in places that are a little bit further up the curve than we are.
So as the director, the medical director for emergency management at UC Health, Dr. Calhoun, what type of preparation do you do for an event like this? I'm sure there's some type of hypothetical scenarios that you have to engage in case something like this does happen. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, there's a lot of different things. One thing is that we try and keep all of our planning in what's called an all-hazards kind of modality, to where much of what we do fits everything. So needing to make a lot of extra space in your hospital is somewhat similar, whether you're doing it because another hospital had to shut down or because you have a large number of patients coming in because of a natural disaster or because you have a lot of patients coming in because of a pandemic. So those concepts of either hospital evacuation or surge planning, those all apply across the board. So you have baseline all-hazards plans that you can then tweak for what you're doing. For instance, in a situation where you're talking about a hospital evacuation, bringing in patients from another hospital, our surge plans typically involve just upregulating everything that we have on scale. So if you normally have 20% ICU beds, you're just multiplying that up. In this case, that's a little bit different because the percentage of admitted patients who are ICU or critical care level patients is higher in this particular disease process than you might see in some other things that you would deal with. So you have to tweak those plans. So we do that. We do things like tabletop exercises and then even full-scale exercises. So many of your listeners probably either saw or heard about or were even involved in some of the recent things. There was one late last year that involved down at the baseball stadium where there was a hypothetical incident that led to a lot of patients. So we do those kind of things. And then we try and train folks in how to manage that. We do, for one instance that keeps coming to mind because it is so parallel to what we're doing, there's an exercise that I use when I teach medical students that relates to a smallpox epidemic. So it's a hypothetical epidemic caused by an intentional release of smallpox. Well, a lot of the concepts of limited resources, limited availability of things, and limited space, as well as the infectious spread, all apply perfectly well to this. So those are the kind of things that we try and do continuously to be able to only have to tweak and finesse things when actual incidents occur.
And Dr. Calhoun, if we do see this surge of patients that have been hinted at, what type of capacity increase do you have? Off-site, are there places off-site that you can utilize?
There's a combination of everything. So in a lot of planning, a lot of times we think about being able to increase our bed capacity by about 50%. That's sort of, in this country, what a lot of us consider to be a pretty reasonable standard surge capacity. So that basically at the drop of the hat, we could bounce by about 50% of what we normally can. It wouldn't be comfortable, it wouldn't be fun, but it's doable. With the models that we're looking at, and there's a lot of different models out there. There's one out of Washington State, there's one out of Penn, there's one coming out of Ohio State, and they all have slightly different assumptions, slightly different math, slightly different numbers that are being put in. And they come up with a different number of patients we're likely to see. The one that we're working off of has the most specific information for Ohio and is giving basically what I refer to as sort of a middle-of-the-road number. And right now, that's putting us at estimating around a 175 to 200% increase in our bed capacity. So that's what all of the healthcare systems in our region right now are working on, is to take what we normally plan for and push that up a little further. And that definitely includes things like examining buildings that you normally wouldn't use for healthcare. One idea of that many people are probably hearing about are concepts such as community alternative care centers, where you're seeing that in New York. One version of that, a really nice version of that, is the Naval Hospital ship. So that's an alternative care center that gets moved into that area is not used to, but it comes fully equipped, fully staffed, and everything else like that. Whereas the other option, you hear people talk about putting up tent cities where they have a hospital in there. In our region, we have a lot of hardened facilities, so those are being considered for sure. But then the idea is you still have to staff those, you still have to put the equipment in there. So those are all the kind of things that go into planning. And the systems in our region work very well together and through the health collaborative, as well as through the Ohio Department of Health, in order to have those kind of plans in place. And those are the things that we're tweaking right now.
And again, we are talking with Dr. Dustin Calhoun. He's an associate professor of emergency medicine and the medical director for emergency management at UC Health. And we started this conversation by talking about the new Cobas 6800 machine, which is supposed to be able to offer 1,000 test results over a 24-hour period. I'm curious, Dr. Calhoun, how UC Health was able to get this. Is there a competitive process for health systems across the country that would like this frequent, fast testing capacity?
Well, so a number of things. The process obviously starts with our lab folks recognizing the need and our health system recognizing the need for the community and being willing to just get in line and make the request, recognizing that there'll be some cost there, but knowing that that's the right thing for the community. But as you can imagine, there are a lot of people wanting the same equipment, the same devices right now. So our health system in our region has an excellent relationship with our government leaders, including Senator Portman, who was critical in aiding us in getting this device because of what he knows this will do for our community. Obviously, we're housing the machine here at UC Health, but our ability to add to the knowledge and the patient care at all the facilities in the region using this machine that Senator Portman helped us obtain is critical. It's multifactorial, but in no small part due to all of those things I mentioned.
And you mentioned about the potential for, what do we call it, false negatives that some people can get if they're possibly tested too soon. But we have seen reports, of course, that asymptomatic people can still spread COVID-19. What is the concern about that conflict that we have here, that we're not testing until people start to show more symptoms, or that we don't want to give the impression that somebody doesn't have it by testing them too soon, but they still might be out there spreading it? Is that just the reason we're still doing the social distancing?
Well, to answer that very briefly, yes, the social distancing is extremely important because without massive and unimaginable amounts of testing, we're never going to be able to test everyone in order to find that. If you had an ideal system, you'd instantly test every single person, and then you'd know exactly where the disease is. You'd isolate those people until they're through the disease, and then you would stop the disease quickly, and that's a pure and perfect containment strategy. Unfortunately, that's just not a reality in the vast majority of these kinds of incidents. So you have to find the balance. And I think, as you were alluding to, there's a lot of factors in that balance, one of which is that we don't have all the information. so we don't know everything there is to know about this virus yet. The amount of asymptomatic viral shedding how contagious is somebody who is not showing symptoms, how soon can they show them after being exposed, how soon can they shed virus and contaminate somebody else or infect someone else after they've been exposed. None of that stuff is known very well. Right now, the best evidence that we're aware of says that the amount of asymptomatic viral shedding is still very low. It's not non-existent, for sure, but it's still very low. So you then have to balance that against the use of personal protective equipment. So the only way to be perfect with this, since we know that you can spread the virus a little bit before getting symptoms, at some point anyways, is to treat everyone if they have it, and that means putting every single person in the protective gear and every provider in the protective gear every single time that you see anyone, and possibly even when you're wandering around. That would work very well if you had unlimited resources, which we don't. So we have to find a balance there. If you burn up all of your resources now, when we know that a pure containment strategy won't work, we know that we're going to get at least some sort of surge of these patients, then when we hit a higher level of that surge and more of these patients actually have COVID-19 compared to now, and more patients would be shedding asymptomatically simply because there are more patients with the disease, then we put people at greater risk if we burn through our supplies of PPE and then people are having to do things like use worn out PPE, compromised PPE, incomplete PPE setup. So those are the balances, and there's no perfect answer. Anybody that thinks they have the perfect answer to this probably hasn't thought through it enough. So we're trying to find the best answer we can at the academic medical center in the region. We are trying to use the best science that's out there and all of our connections through the other academic centers and the other agencies around the country that have dealt with this to try and find what is the right time to trigger increased use of PPE in order to come out at the end with the safest outcome possible.
And Dr. Calhoun, I know we're short on time, and I know you're very, very busy. One last thing before you go. Do you have enough PPE? Is that a concern among your staff?
Well, I think my shortest answer would be no one ever has enough PPE. It's protective. Anything that's protective, I'll take as much of it as I can get. Do we think we're going to be able to manage our PPE in a responsible way that's going to allow our providers to be protected appropriately and our patients to be protected appropriately throughout the surge of this? Yes, it's going to be a lot of work. We're going to have to do a lot of balancing, and we're going to have to try and continue to follow the science as best we can. But we do feel that by following that science and trying to be a leader as the Academic Medical Center, we feel that we will be able to balance that and provide the protection we need.
Dr. Dustin Calhoun is an associate professor of emergency medicine and the medical director for emergency management at UC Health. Dr. Calhoun, thank you so much for your time, and please stay safe.
My pleasure. Stay safe and wash your hands.
Thank you for that. We'll talk again soon.